The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Champions League magic is back. Class bars play arse off the grass, make more passes than Paris Hilton on Mastermind. And just to make matters worse for Wenger boys, Spurs go through, dropping seven-time winners Milan like one of Ari's H's. We give the games the usual thorough pod going over with the word from Sid in Spain and Paolo reading an Italian paper. Other big stories, Man United Arsenal in the FA Cup quarterfinals, that random Chechnya match with Brazil, that random red card for the Mancini tackle, and the Bundesliga, lame duck domino and Van Gaal's long goodbye. All of that and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Here we are then with Football Weekly Extra, Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
Hello, Paolo. Raphael Honigstein.
Ciao.
Ciao. Eyebrow cocked in a raffish fashion. No pun intended, but not quite sure what's going on there. He's got some devilry planned, I'm suggesting. Tom Lutz.
I'll just go for hello. I'll just stick with hello.
You're simple, you know, plain. You don't need to dress things up, do you, Tom?
No.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Spurs Milan, well done, Spurs. How about this? Harry Redknapp is the first English manager ever to make it into the quarterfinals of the Champions League.
It's pretty good.
And the first English manager in Champions League stroke European Cup since 1986, I believe.
Terry Venables?
Yeah, Barcelona. He read the same thing as I did.
I didn't read it, actually, but he's abended.
He read the same thing that
I did, didn't he? Well, there you go. Anyway, a 0-0 at White Hart Lane against Milan. And a 0-0 that was hailed as a great victory. They're dreaming the impossible dream, was Redknapp's comment, as they go through to the quarterfinals on their first time, the club as well, in the Champions League. Tactically spot on?
Well, I don't know, because certainly, you know, at key points in the game, and certainly in the second half, I think they were really inviting Milan onto them. And I think of all the things you do to Milan, that's the one thing you absolutely don't do, is give them time, allow them to play the ball, allow them to pick the passes. And in the end, it was fine. And Tottenham did an excellent job of defending. I think Dawson and Gallas were huge. Sandro was absolutely magnificent, I thought, in front of the back four, just constantly breaking up play. So in that sense, you know, they defended very well, but actually, was that the smartest thing to do against Milan? I don't know. I think actually you might have been better off going at them and not allowing them that time, pressing them higher up the pitch.
It's funny because I had the same reaction while watching the game. Why are they letting Milan have so much time when we know that time is the one thing you deny the Italian clubs and they can't deal with that? But while the Italian papers, Ways Gazzetta in the air, say, wow, we dominated this game, the best team have gone out, that's the big headline on the front page, maybe it wasn't a mistake because Harry Redknapp goes through. Maybe he knew that Ibrahimovic and Rabinho weren't going to do anything with all that.
I think there's always a difficulty to look at the way a game pans out and then immediately assume that these were the intended tactics. I don't think Spurs wanted to be that deep. I don't think they wanted to cede so much possession.
Why did they put no pressure at all on any?
Because I think your natural instinct, if you're protecting a lead, is to go back further and further and further. It actually takes a lot of courage and coaching to keep people pressing because you leave so much back space at the back that you instinctively don't want to do that. You go deeper and deeper and deeper and you allow Milan into the game. But I don't think that was the game plan at all. And you see in the second half, after that, had a bit of a prep talk, presumably at halftime, to tell them, Redknapp told them, you know, go out there and get at them a bit more. They were a lot sharper, and while it didn't create that much, they, to me, were a lot more in the game. And I think it was a very good performance overall. A bit like Arsenal, I think you can't necessarily look at how the game unfolds and think, this was their plan and it didn't work or it did work. Because as Sartre said, everything is complicated by the presence of the other team.
My Sky is broken at the moment, so I had to watch it through.
Your Sky is broken?
Not like Sky in the sky, but my Sky TV. So every time the 56 went past my house, the picture broke up last night.
Is that a regular service?
The 56, it's about six to eight minutes in the evenings. 10 to 12 minutes later on, after midnight. So, over the course of a match, that was 15 times it went past.
I didn't see
the whole match. Yeah. So, but I thought the pace it was played at was almost Premier League style, and I don't know if that kind of hindered Milan as well.
I think Milan set out to play at a higher pace than they normally do. Yeah. I think certainly they were playing at a much higher pace than they did in the last couple of games, but I think that was in their game plan, was to try and, you know, because they haven't been very creative in the last few games, to be honest, in Serie A. They were pretty, you know, miserable against Juventus in terms of what they're actually creating at the weekend. So they needed to give themselves a spark, and they tried to do that.
With Seydal coming in the Pirlo role. Mm. Rafa, was that what you were
talking
about?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was my point. I think you see this game, you watch this game, you think there must be huge criticism on Allegri, not for what they did this time, but for what they did in 3 weeks ago, where they got it completely wrong, played Seydal in the worst possible position. And you see, you saw last night what a difference he can still make when he plays in a position he's comfortable.
When he's given that much time as well, because I think were he to have faced the kind of pressure that an English team would normally have thrown at an Italian team, I don't know how well he would have done. He's been having a miserable season, regularly booed and whistled off the field at the San Siro. Luke Slater, among the many people asking why Seydal wasn't used in that deep-lying role against Spurs, why hasn't that happened more often? I think the fact that, to my mind, Spurs did let Milan play the game a bit is one of the factors, and that wouldn't necessarily have happened in the first leg. The other one is the fact that the San Siro, I don't think Milan can play like that. They can't even try and play like that because there's a beautiful pitch at White Hart Lane. You try playing that kind of football at San Siro, it's just not going to happen.
Do you know, it was funny, you touched on it last week, and there's obviously this issue over the last weekend in Italy where Scully went off and there was a supposition at first, which I think now has been said it probably wasn't that he had had an allergic reaction to this thing which is called vernice, you know, sort of varnish paint they put on the pitch in Italy. And what's great about this is, you know, again, you touched on it, but this
varnish
was
on a pitch?
They literally introduced this because Italian pitches are often in a very bad state. San Siro is a very bad one, but this was basically introduced at the behest of TV companies a few years ago because the Italian product didn't look good enough. So rather than fix the pitches, they said, let's paint the pitches so they look more like those ones in England.
So it's just more green looking.
Yeah, right, basically. Okay. But, you know, it was interesting with this game, I thought, how differently it was received. And, you know, it's always going to be a bit like this. But I think if you look at the Barcelona-Arsenal game, which we'll get to in a minute, actually the judgment on it was fairly similar in England and Spain. But the difference with this was received in England and Italy is huge. In England, it was, oh, Tottenham were heroic. They defended. They you know, they did exactly what they needed to do. In Italy, as you said, Gazzetta's front page was the best team go out. You know, it's the same in most every paper. You know, in La Repubblica, they were saying Spurs played one good half out of four and got lucky on a counter-attack. In Gazzetta again, Garlando says, you know, the immediate sensation is that with Pippo Inzaghi healthy today, yeah, Milan would be in the quarterfinals.
Yeah.
Actually, he might be right on that, because if you look at yesterday's game, I do think if ever there was a game designed for Super Pippo to come off the bench with 20 minutes to go, that was it, because yeah, Milan were at that point where they were playing around outside the area but not finding a way through.
If you're looking for the guilty parties at Milan, certainly Allegri, the tactical setup in the first half of the first leg was a bit disastrous, but also Milan's management. Inzaghi out, and the reinforcements they brought in for this massive injury crisis that they had in January were all cup-tied. Cassano cup-tied. Van Bommel, although, you know, you're not short on midfield battlers, I suppose.
No, I mean, but they brought in players as, you know, as ever, except, you know, Rabinho and Inzaghi. Every signing Milan are making is a way of, oh, well, that's a good player who can get very little. And that was the case with Cassano and Van Bommel. And it wasn't really thought about where, you know, necessarily in that sense. It was just, well, these are good players and we can get them very cheap. But I do think it's a situation they've created for themselves with this expenditure they've had on attackers. You've got, you know, you've got Ibrahimovic there who, obviously, the talk is all of him being a big game bottler again. I actually think that perhaps more salient is the fact that he's gone now 700 minutes without scoring an open play in all competitions. I think he tends to get into a rut at this time of year. I think certainly in his Serie A seasons, you would see a similar pattern through a lot of his time in Serie A, where this is the time of year when he does badly.
So it's not also big happens games, it's to games coincide. In spring.
Well, quite, because he then tends to pick up at the end of the season and score important games in the title race. And I just wonder if there's an element of perhaps this happens to be a time of year where whatever to do with his fitness, he always finds himself in bad form at some year. And also, I think on the big game bottler issue, you need to look at last year at Barcelona and that game against Stuttgart, which he effectively got them out of a period where they weren't playing very well. He scored twice against Arsenal. I think it's an oversimplistic argument to say that he just doesn't score in these games.
That's why I like it so much. But a brilliant explanation. Very, very interesting that. I think we should probably move on at this point to Arsenal and their trip to the Camp Nou. Joe Roberts says, pancake day gets messy as Arsenal are thoroughly battered. Indeed they were. Well done, Barcelona. Awesome stats. I'm sure we've all seen them. I'm sure we've all seen the pass map of the game, which was entirely blue with the odd little red speck in the corner. And Arsenal, indeed, the first side ever in the Champions League since Opta started compiling stats in 2003 to have no shots on goal. And yet, they could have gone through.
Mm-hmm. Well, me and Paolo were discussing this yesterday, actually, that for a side that completely dominated Arsenal for 180 minutes, not 90 minutes, but 180 minutes, they very nearly went out Barcelona. And and particularly Arsenal's goal in the Nou Camp, Barcelona had three men willing to head that in. And it was just, I fear for them later in the tournament if they actually find someone who could come up against a side that can finish.
If they don't get the first choice centre backs back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you said about the first choice centre backs, and to be fair, I suppose they had the same situation with the away leg, with the leg in at the Camp Nou last year. But actually, I'd say over four games with Arsenal, maybe not always as comprehensively this time, but if basically Barcelona have solidly outplayed Arsenal in every single one of them. And they lost to Emirates last year. Sorry, they lost to Emirates this year, drew with them at Emirates last year. They do seem to not take as many of their chances as they should for a team that's as brilliant as they are as creating those chances. It seems that even with David Villa there, they're still not as clinical as you'd want them to
be.
Yeah,
they are a bit rubbish, aren't they? let's just get a couple of comments here. Wonk says, blah, 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 red card. But had Van Persie been on the end of that ball rather than Bentner, it might have been a different story. It's a fair point, but here comes some other views. Toon, Van Persie, yes, he was stupidly dismissed, but whose fault is it that Bentner is their reserve striker? Would Barca tolerate Bentner as their backup? The Woolsey Mammoth says, while red card was ludicrous, not like Van Persie didn't know he was offside and doesn't know the rules. And all this business about Bentner's chance, it was only the second or third time Arsenal actually touched the ball inside the Barcelona penalty box. Arsenal fans seem to think that because they had a ball and a player in the box at the same time, it would surely be a goal. There was rather more to it than that. Kick in the nads. Arsene Wenger, 10 years to build a reputation up as a football purist, just 2 hours to tear it down, and for what? They still got knocked out. Spanish View, Sid Lowe's on the line. Sid.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sid. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm ever so well. Stop your bleating and take your beating. That's the view of the Spanish press on Arsene Wenger, etc. Discuss.
The immediate reaction after the game was uniform in the Spanish media that Arsenal had no real reason to complain. Bear in mind as well, and I think this is really important because this has happened before, the immediate reaction, of course, is written pretty quickly after the game. So it's an immediate sense of what they've seen, what's happened in front of their eyes. And the reaction in Spain was very much that Arsenal, yes, it's true that Van Persie maybe shouldn't have been sent off, although I suppose, rule book in hand, perhaps he should have been sent off. That Barcelona had just been far, far, far superior to Arsenal throughout the game. Then what happened, of course, was that they then had a day to think about it. And, of course, the Madrid media had a day to think about it and thought, hey, this fits quite nicely with our conspiracy theory about how everyone's out to help Barcelona as much as possible. This could work really nicely. So today, Marca and AS, two main Madrid newspapers, have run with the complaints from England about the referee as if that's kind of exhibit A in their case against Barcelona, exhibit A in their case that Barcelona are really not very good. They're just a bunch of cheats who always have the referees on their side. So when we talk about a Spanish reaction, it's both sides. Now, that particular mentality was picked up really, really strongly yesterday from Javier Mascherano in his press conference at Barcelona. And he went on a long monologue anyway, much like the one I'm going on right now, in which he said, it doesn't matter if we have 20 shots and the other team doesn't have any. It doesn't matter if we play brilliantly. It doesn't matter if we're in possession. None of that matters. Barcelona win because of the referee. Of course, being sarcastic.
What was your view of Arsenal? Because I saw one or two comments in the Spanish press almost blaming them for betraying their ideals and not playing attacking football. But to me, it looked more as if Barcelona just completely stopped them and frustrated them. It wasn't by design that they decided, OK, we're just going to defend all day.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to know exactly where the cause is, whether it's one team or the other or a combination of both. I certainly did think early on that Mascherano had been right in his pre-match comments, which we ran in the paper on Monday, I think, where Mascherano was saying, look, Arsenal aren't stupid. They may well have a certain approach. They may well be almost puritanical in their football approach. They talk about playing a nice game, but they've got a lead. They're not stupid. They're going to try and protect their lead. I wouldn't go far to say park the bus, but I thought they were more defensive than normal. But as you say, I think whether they were defensive or whether they were forced back by Barcelona is another issue. And there's a comment from Juanma León, who is the former Almeria coach. And the reason why it's significant was twofold. One, because Juanma León is seen in some circles as almost being Pep Guardiola's mentor. And the other, because Juanma León was the Almeria coach who lost 8-0 to Barcelona earlier this season. And the thing is that people talk about how you approach Barcelona and what you do and how you play them. And he said, the thing is, against Barcelona, you don't play, you don't do what you want to do, you do what you can do. And I think there was an element of that because I think that Arsenal were probably made to look even more defensive than they'd intended to be because Barcelona pushed them back so much.
Well, here we go then with part two. Paolo, the FA Cup. A trip to Old Trafford. Is it exactly the kind of game that Arsenal needs at this moment, or exactly the kind of game they don't need at this moment? Well, or somewhere in between?
Yeah, can I answer that question on Monday?
Oh, right.
No, I mean, you're going to get these games at this point in the season. If you didn't, then you'd be disappointed because you wouldn't be in competitions worth playing for. But
do you think that they're up for this? Can they respond to these disappointments?
Well, I mean, I think the concern that's going to be for Arsenal is once again going to be about the players that are missing. And obviously, Cesc Fabregas said he twinged something went off again. That whole decision to play against Barcelona does, you know, with hindsight, it looks like a slightly selfish decision on his point.
Perhaps
a lack of strength from Wenger in not saying to him, you know, you're not fit, and even though you're my captain, it might be better for the team to have someone else in there. Although, again, with Song also out, you wonder what the other options were. Danielson hasn't exactly covered himself in glory that often this season, so there's players like that you'd be talking about bringing in. Although I also thought Diaby was a total passenger against Barcelona, and these are the problems that were problems against Barcelona, and problems again against Manchester United. Is how you're going to square that circle in midfield, and what have you got up front? Is Van Persie? We don't know if he was fit enough or not for that game against Barcelona because he never saw the football. So I assume he'll start again against Manchester United, but after an injury that was supposed to keep him out for 3 weeks, it's a lot in a short space of time.
The last time Arsenal were seriously challenging for the titles, there was an FA Cup game in 2008, wasn't there? And Wenger decided to field a weakened side. Yeah. They lost 4-0, and after that, they won like two of the next 10 games. So it can have a psychological effect on the title race as well as just an FA Cup game.
Yeah, I certainly don't think he'll field the weakened side this time.
He has said the league is the priority.
Yeah, and it will be his priority, but I can't imagine, for exactly the reason that Tom outlines, I can't imagine that he would feel the team like he did in 2008. I think that would be... Well, if he does, I think people are going to be very, very angry.
It's not only Arsenal, of course, who are looking to respond to disappointments. Man United have had a setback or two of late as well, and are facing the team who are now putting real pressure on them at the top of the table. Arsenal, 3 points behind United, but with a game in hand.
Are they putting real pressure on them, or are Manchester United putting real pressure on themselves?
That's if they weren't called Arsenal, we'd regard this as a very tight title race. Yeah, but I think it's a mistake to assume they're just going to blow it again.
I absolutely think you're right, and I think it is a tight title race, and I think it would be a mistake to write Arsenal out of it. However, you know, Arsenal had a real opportunity last week to put pressure on by beating.
They still gained a point on United.
Well, they did, but only because United lost two games in 2 weeks. They could be right up there, you know, right with United instead of 3 points behind them still. Absolutely, it's, you know, United do have caused problems, and you're going to have to cut this bit because I don't entirely know what their situation is with Ferdinand and Vidic, so I don't know what to say on that.
Vidic was suspended for the league, so is he back now or not? Because it's this weird system in England where suspensions count for both league and cup. How many games was he out for? It wasn't a straight rib, was it?
No, it's two bookings. He'll be back.
And Ferdinand's still out.
So Ferdinand, I assume, would be out. I haven't seen anything about him being back, but...
Okay, well then, you've got the situation at United as well at the moment where they're still missing Rio Ferdinand, so they are vulnerable, they're not at their very best, but equally, you know, United's bad results have basically come away from home. They're not. Mm. They're going to be at Old Trafford this weekend. It's going to be a different situation to what it was at Anfield.
I think it's a real headache, that game, for both teams, a game that really don't want... Yes, it's nice to get to the FA Cup, but they've got bigger fish to fry, certainly United. After two losses in the league, they have to respond, but I would expect that if it hadn't been for those losses, they'd be saying, yeah, you know, we'll try to win this, but it's not the worst thing in the world if we get knocked out. And the same for Arsenal. But now it's become fairly big, and possibly bigger than they wanted it to be. So it's, yeah.
Which for Arsenal is also to do with the Carling Cup. If they'd won the Carling Cup, it would be a lot easier for him to say, well, we've won something now, and now we can actually worry about what's important, rather than being in this position of, well, everyone's going to keep talking about us not winning a trophy until it happens.
Mm. Still right. On for the double, though.
Still on for the double.
Every year we get to this point of the year and they start talking about every English team that's left in competitions. It's all, they can still win the quadruple, they can still win the treble. United won the treble, and since then and before then, nothing. So why do we assume, just because a team happens to still be in, you know, some last 16s and quarterfinals this time of year, that it's a serious possibility they're going to win trebles and quadruples?
Yeah, why?
They won the treble.
Anyway, Birmingham's double chances then. We've seen them lift the League Cup, and you're going to be facing, Birmingham, of course, going to be facing Bolton, coming off a draw at Everton in the always prestigious derby of the Ginger Scots managers.
Yeah, it's one of the bigger derbies in the Premier League. Birmingham have got a few injuries at the moment, but there's... actually, the most interesting thing about last night's game for the neutral was that Peter Walton, the referee, forgot to pack his cards in the first half. So he went to book Jordan Much, I think, in the 40th minute. And he just had to, like, put his hand up and then wag his finger at Much. And then the fourth official came on and said, yeah, here's your cards. So that was quite amusing. You can see it on YouTube, which I believe is a popular site with the young people these days. As for the game itself, Birmingham have had a few injuries, and it's let some of their less recognised players kind of shine a bit. Jean-Beau Sejour, who was brilliant for Chile in the World Cup, actually was playing just behind Jerome last night and scored a nice goal. Mm. So despite the fact that you've kind of got people like Fahy out, it was a good result as well. Yeah. They're out of the relegation
point
zone.
At Goodison. You're up against Bolton in the quarterfinals. Everton, meanwhile, are seeing Mikel Arteta, who's had a miserable season, really. He was just finding some form again. And out he goes with, what is it, hamstring or something? He's out for the rest of the season, perhaps? Something like that. Anyway, there you go. In other quarterfinal news, Stoke will be hosting West Ham, who just beat them Tom?
I was just going to say about West Ham.
Oh, yeah.
If they're through to the semis, Grant's got to them semi-finals, the League Cup and the FA Cup. This is a manager that people wanted sacked about 2 or 3 months ago. And as well, when he got...
Just imagine what they could have done with the real manager.
Well, but this is the thing. When he got Chelsea to the Champions League final, everybody went, oh, well, it's just Chelsea. They're a good side. Then when he got Portsmouth to the FA Cup final, everybody's like, oh, well, they had nothing to play for, so the pressure's off them. And now if he gets West Ham, they stay up and he gets them to the semi-finals or the final.
It could happen.
FA Cup. It could happen that everybody would be like, oh, well, Scott Parker led them there. So... isn't it about time
it's
that
actually
we give
true that's yeah. the thing it is actually
three
true
times.
I mean if you have to resort to the captain doing the halftime speech,
oh, wow.
because
what's wrong with
from,
that
no because there's nothing from the manager, then it gives you some sort of indication.
It's good management of resources. He's inspirational. I'm not. He'll do the whole thing.
That's what he did at Chelsea.
Serious.
That's exactly
why
what he did
Why does the manager
Chelsea?
Have to be inspirational?
No, you're right.
Tactical. Let's buy Demba Ba, who Stoke could have had and came back to Hornham, etc. Then you know, it was going to be interesting seeing what happens in that game. I'm a big Avram Grant fan myself.
Don't tell Jacob Steinberg.
I won't otherwise. Tell Jacob Steinberg.
The thing is, if yes. you can... afford to be hands off if you've got a team that functions and a team of players who will be willing to take responsibility and who will sort things out themselves, and if they have a decent quality, you
like
know, you'll get decent
Bennett,
results
basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when things need to be addressed, when things are not happening in the game, when you need changes, then you need actually someone who is in charge, who has ideas, has authority, and that's why they're down in the doldrums, whereas they should be in a comfortable mid-table if you look at the squad.
No? All right. Well, both sides to that argument then. The other quarterfinal will see Man City taking on the Championship's Reading. 2,800 Reading fans will be attending this match at Eastlands, and they will be arriving, or at least they have the offer to be arriving, on free coaches laid on by Mr. Badeski himself, presumably bought from the pages of his Auto Trader magazine. But anyway, it's lovely, isn't it? Yeah. What chance the Royals against the Citizens? Topical question. What was that wedding hoo-ha on the way? They're coming off a huge win, Reading. They beat somebody with 5 goals the other day. I can't remember who it was. It was a cracking game. Anyway, in other news of a not necessarily Champions or Premier League nature, Dorchester Town player-manager Ashley Vickers sent off for intervening on Monday after a streaker did several laps of the field in a green mankini. I have to say, having watched this with you, Tom, you shared this with me, somebody had to step up and take this crazed loon down, and he did.
He did, and he did it well as well. Although it was an odd venue to, as right. you were saying, to streak in front of 200 fans. He could have gone for a bigger...
Why?
Like that Man United fan who always turns up and when there's 80,000 people.
Yeah, but that makes sense. Yeah. You said to me, after, did you see his tackle? I said, no, the mankini was exactly the badum-tish and all that. But it did seem a bit harsh to actually send him off for it.
Letter of the law, it was correct. Yeah. You know, you are the ref, the observers, popular section,
yes,
where various far-fetched scenarios take place that you say would never take place in real life. In 2006, they had this.
No.
And Keith Hackett said, yes, the player goes.
Why?
Because it's violent conduct. And it doesn't matter whether that's against a supporter.
But the stewards weren't stepping up and taking fellas out. I can understand their reticence, because there's something about a Mancini that makes you want to walk in the opposite direction. Yeah.
But no, letter of the law, he was correct. The referee's got no sense of humour, but he is right.
All right.
That's spectacular knowledge.
Good knowledge, Tom. Yeah. All right. That's it for part two. But worry not, listeners, we've got an absolutely amazing part three coming up very, very shortly. So very much saving the best for last in today's Football Weekly Extra. Tom Pearson posts in, here's a post or two. Pod, has there ever been a more ludicrous game than the Chechnya versus Brazil affair? Don't think anyone emerges from this with very much credit, do they?
Oh, I think...
Well, they might have some credit in the bank.
Well, it might do, yeah.
Brazilian players. Yeah.
I personally thought Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov emerged with great credit after scoring two goals against the 2002 World Cup winning side.
Yes. Good touch for a big politician.
Yeah.
Yeah, just paint a picture for anyone who didn't come across the disturbing details.
The Chechen all-star team featuring Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov lost 6-4 to the 2002 World Cup winners.
Why were they playing against the 2002?
Money, I think, is the answer.
But they invited, basically, the Brazil side from which World Cup was 2002, yeah?
Yeah. Yes, they did. They invited him. And in the words of Kadyrov, I believe it was a show we wanted people to understand through football that we are a peaceful nation.
Right. Rather than through reading the headlines about the armed insurrection and
the
bombing.
Human.
Yeah, yeah. 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 Right. Okay. Well, as I say, it is a bit disturbing when people, you know, always maybe admired. They're not necessarily going to put Ruud Gullit in there, but I mean, why do they all go there? I mean, how much money do you want?
Always more.
Always more. Do we want? Sorry, I'm getting a bit moral here, but...
It's got a more positive international story. Yep. Palestine played their first home international. Was it last night? Against Thailand.
All right, see, why didn't Brazil go and play Palestine? That would have sent a message.
Palestine isn't flush with cash at the moment.
Tell you what, let's speak out on global issues. Other posts, Random Bloke is also concerned. He says, has anyone managed to explain how, if snoods are so very dangerous, they can still be worn until next season? Isn't that a bit like saying you can only knife fight until you're 21? Interesting point, that. Champions League. We haven't finished by any means with the round of 16 fixtures because, of course, Schalke, big win against Valencia, Raphael.
Very big win in slightly bizarre circumstances because, well, on the day, or a few hours before that game, it was leaked that Magad is basically out of the job at the end of the season. It was a decision that was made by the board quite a while ago. They kept it secret, which is no mean feat for Schalke because things always leak there. But on Wednesday, a couple of papers actually did run the story. So they went into this game knowing that, well, thinking that Magad will be out. Magad sort of played a blind and said, no one's talked to me. I don't know anything. I'm staying put. And it was a great game. Raul played really well. Farfan scored two wonderful goals, one a great free kick and one a little dink right at the end. And Schalke somehow got there by fighting and running and sort of doing what they do best. And Valencia didn't have much to counter that.
Is this a new thing in Germany, then, that you get to the quarterfinals of Europe's premier competition, as Bayern Munich also looks set to do, and then because of that you get yourself announced you're going to be fighting in the season? Or?
Yes, it's become known as the lame duck domino. More and more managers seem to get their marching orders for the end of the season but stay in the job. Magath, Van Gaal, Armin Fee, Hamburg. And the domino effect is because people are saying that one of the possible candidates to succeed Van Gaal at Bayern is Jupp Heynckes. So if that announcement were to be made, he'd be a lame duck at Leverkusen.
Right.
Leverkusen want to appoint Robin Dutt from Freiburg, who would then be a lame duck until the end of that season. And the domino duck effect continues.
Yeah.
What's lame duck in German?
Lame Ente.
So it's just the same thing.
Yeah.
Lame Ente Domino.
I should say, this is a coin. This is a term coined by Süddeutsche Zeitung. But not by me.
Your paper?
Yes.
All right, it's fantastic.
It's it's been a really, really weird season. And as you said, and not only
our papers come up with stuff like Harry Verdurci.
That's not our paper.
Well, I mean, it's English papers.
Yeah. the other thing is with Schalke, of course, not only are they in the quarterfinals, but also in the German Cup final.
Ah. And where are they in the league?
Well, that is the problem. They're down.
Yeah.
They're 3 or 4 points clear of relegation, which is not something they want. And today there was some more sort of leaking reasons behind this move, and it basically confirmed what everybody knew about Margot for quite a few years ago. Somebody within the club called him a social incompetent, that he's so harsh and cold towards people that after a maximum of 1 year, 2 years, just people cannot stand the guy anymore.
Right.
And just as he did at Wolfsburg, where he won the title and was and left, and people were happy to see him leave, and at Bayern, where he won two doubles back-to-back, he sort of runs this course and people can't take it anymore.
I'm curious, so the Facebook page, will that be now closed down for Felix Magath?
It's still there. Oh. It's still there. He's still collecting fans, and he did post yesterday before the game that, I'm not fazed by all these rumours. I'm going to be sticking onto this job, but yeah.
All right.
Are we going to talk about Inter?
Yeah, well, you've already written off their chances of making it to the quarterfinals.
I have written off Inter's chance of making it to quarterfinals because I think there's been this blindness to the fact that it's nearly 20 years since the Champions League became the Champions League,
yeah.
And only one team in all that time has lost the home leg of a knockout game and gone on to go through. That's once since then. So the odds very much
don't suggest
what they'll do it. It was Ajax in 1996. They lost 1-0 at home to Panathinaikos in the semi-final and won the return leg 3-0.
Right.
So there's that. And I mean, admittedly, you know, Raphael...
That's a kind of Sean Inglesque argument. History books mean nothing. Inter on a good run of form. Bayern aren't.
Inter on a good run of form. I think, you know, I'm going to have to ask Raphael to speak to Bayern because, you know, he obviously watches them a lot more than I do. I think Inter on a good run of form, but at the same time remain very, very vulnerable. I think you could see that against even the Genoa game at the weekend. They're conceding goals very easily. They're scoring goals very easily. If you'd asked me at the beginning of this week which Italian team had the best chance of the three of them going through, I certainly would have said it was Inter, but I would also suggest that the bookies. I'll follow up my Sean Ingle stat with a Sean Ingle bookie reference. But I would certainly say that the bookies have it right at the moment, which they expect Bayern not only to progress but to win the game.
I like how Sean Ingle is now just a byword for rubbish argument.
That's not rubbish argument. It's saying that Sean likes his bookies odds and he likes his statistics,
but essentially invalid.
Well, if this week's results are anything to go. By with, and second leg home advantage is still very, very big. But if you look at Bayern's form, nothing is impossible from Inter's perspective, because they have been absolutely abject, certainly at the back. They've been all over the place. Going forward, they are completely predictable. Every team they come up against with now knows how to deal with them, negate their threat. The one thing, of course, they have for themselves is that they have already the advantage. So they can play from a position of strength, which will suit them and make it a lot more difficult for Inter to employ the tactics that have worked so well against them, where teams have just really pressurized and sit deep and hit them on the counter. It's going to be tough for Inter to do, because I think Bayern will be quite happy to just keep the ball and run the clock down as much as possible. From Bayern's point of view, a lot of it rides on the Saturday game with Hamburg, because if they were to chalk up their fourth defeat in a row, I think all hell might really break loose, and Van Gaal might not even make it to Tuesday. If they win or if they draw and play in a semi-convincing fashion, then you'd think that sort of Champions League, the moment, the occasion kicks in, and the Van Gaal stuff sort of gets to the background, because the players want to go through, and whether Van Gaal stays or not will be pretty much immaterial. And I for one, actually don't believe in this whole lame duck theory that much. I don't think it's really that relevant for managers, whether they leave or don't leave at the end of the season.
Oh, I hate to do an Ingle, but I think the statistics don't back you up on that. Generally, if teams know that their manager is leaving at the end of the season, the results always fall. Well, I say always. In most cases, the results fall off badly.
Where are these stats?
Well, I would say when they're mostly Italian, in my experience, when Marcello Lippi, who'd done nothing but win at Juventus, announced midway through the season that he was going at the end of the year, all of a sudden Juve stopped winning. When Sven-Göran Eriksson had just won the title at Lazio, January, the FA come calling and he says, yes, I will join England, but I'm going to stay until the end of the season. Lazio do so badly that within weeks he's out, and they can't remember who it was who came. Was it Mancini who was promoted straight?
I think it was after Eriksson.
Anyway, but sorry.
No, I take your point, but I would counter it with two things. One, right. You might be confusing cause and effect. You might the managers might leave because they see this team has run its course and is not going to be succeeding in the future, and they leave.
Do a red nap. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and they see the team not performing well, and then people are saying it's because he's left, but he's actually leaving because he knows the teams are not the team. The other point is, of course, that every World Cup, every tournament, 85-90% of coaches are lame ducks, and I don't think you could say, oh, France, they were rubbish because people knew he was out, because
it would have had the opposite effect.
Well, 2008, they were also rubbish, where he wasn't a lame duck.
Right. Very finally, in other Champions League last 16 news, Roma at Shakhtar Donetsk, 3-2 down from the leg in Rome, a 3-0 defeat in the Ukraine. A lot of people saying, you know, this Donetsk team, they could be the dark horses in the quarterfinals. They're not that special at the back, are they, Donetsk? They give you chances, which Roma spectacularly failed to take. And the Italian press, probably, Paolo, you're about to say, I think really depressed by Roma's performance, not least because it showed all the worst aspects of their game.
Yeah, well, I mean, just quickly on Donetsk at the back, I think you could look at Arsenal's home game against them earlier in the year and say they've certainly got their flaws. Roma's defeat was a really unfortunately what I think a lot of people might call a classically Roman way to go out, because they didn't just go out, they really imploded. They had a chance at 1-0 to bring it back to 1-1 with a penalty, which then ridiculously Borriello got to take because he hadn't scored in a while. They decided it wouldn't be Pizarro.
I think he decided that.
Well, yeah, but what sort of a team attitude is that, that no one stepped forward and said, no, hang on, we're in the Pizarro middle of a really important game. Yeah. We should let our penalty taker take
Borriello,
the penalty.
Who was caught by cameras the other day when he was left on the bench, saying to himself, I'm sat here on the bench and I've scored 25,000 goals.
Yeah, which is possibly a slight exaggeration of his prowess. But then after, even after the game, you had De Rossi was
red card. Yeah, De Rossi with another elbow.
An elbow, and then also went over to Luchesco at the end of the game and shared some choice words with him. It was really depressing stuff from Roma, at a point where a lot of people thought they might be okay beginning to at least come back together as a team a little bit and pull themselves together under Montella. It's really just fallen apart again.
I mean, I'd hate to rub sort of salt into Italian wounds, but has there ever been a season since the European football started where Italy had no teams left at this stage in all competitions?
Yes. Only about 3 years ago, was it?
Really?
Yeah, it happened.
No teams in the quarterfinals, yeah. I think maybe, in the UEFA Cup, there was somebody still in the UEFA Cup.
Oh, yes, you might be right. There might be someone in the UEFA Cup, yeah.
Hey, early days, though, eh? Early days.
Well, not really.
Well, no, I mean, if Inter goes through and that's it. I'm laughing.
France, tears. You better watch your back. France are coming.
Don't mention the coefficient.
That's what they said in Italy.
Yeah. There's no worries about France's coefficient. Sorry, Paolo, you were going to say?
No, I was just going to say we were discussing this just before we came in.
Oh, yeah.
I think Raphael is exaggerating the risk of France and the coefficient because he's assuming that France will get more points this year, which they probably will get more points this year, and the gap will be narrowed when the next 2 years drop off the end of the chart. But I think it's extrapolating quite a lot to say that suddenly, when there's been no previous examples of France exceeding Italy, to say that this is going to be the norm from now on.
Right. Yes. Roma, anyway, having their disastrous exit from Europe, and they've got the derby at the weekend. Massive game there against a Lazio team who are currently lying fourth in Serie A, 5 points ahead of Roma. This is a must-win fixture for Roma's ambitions of finishing in the top four, which still this season, Rafa, does give you a place in the Champions League.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah. The other big game we should mention, Sampdoria away at Catania. Paolo, you called this. They could be going from Champions League to Serie B in the space of a season.
I don't feel pleased with myself because I quite like Samp as a team, but I did say right after Pazzini was sold, I said in my blog that relegation, I didn't necessarily say they were definitely going down, but I said it is now a serious consideration, and since that time I think they've picked up something like 4 points
and they've scored about four goals since
literally. But it was obvious. You look at Sampdoria last season, and you only, to be honest, you only need to look at what players were paid, because last season and indeed the beginning of this season, the three top earners, there were only three players in the whole squad who were earning more than €1 million a year. Those were Cassano, Pazzini and Palombo. Now only Palombo's still there. You've taken away your attack that was the whole you know, the whole reason why this team was so successful was having this wonderful strike partnership of Cassano and Pazzini that was clearly, you know, of a much higher calibre than the rest of their team. They also lost their goalkeeper in the summer. So, you know, I think that it was kind of inevitable this was going to happen. And to assume that Massimo Maccarone, you know, a player who's never...
And Federico Macheda,
who, you know, so an unproven player and another one who's never consistently scored a lot of goals through his career, to assume that they could pick up the slack of two players like Pazzini and Cassano was always madness.
Well, they now lost their manager as well. Mimmo Di Carlo getting the bullet after their defeat at home to Cesena last weekend, and they are 3 points from the drop, but they're against this weekend one of their direct relegation rivals, Catania, down in Sicily. Alberto Cavazzin, a former Serie A manager of the season, coming in there.
Only a short decade ago.
Was it that long ago now?
I believe it was...
Lecce.
It was at Lecce. I'm not sure if it was 2000 or if it was... it was in that ballpark, though.
Yeah. All right, then. Interesting. Now, Tom Lutz, time to say goodbye. Anything you want to add?
Not really.
Okay, then. Rafael Honigstein, many thanks.
Thank you.
Always informative and interesting viewpoint on the week in football. And Paolo Bandini, same to you.
Cheers.
Thanks, listeners, for making the whole thing worthwhile. And producer Ben is not going to be here the next week or two. Ay, caramba. We'll be back on Monday with our review of the weekend's action. There will be on Friday morning, if you've got 5 minutes to spare, a quick roundup of what the European papers made of all the week's events. So perhaps you can join me for that. If not, see you Monday and have a super time till then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.